Hey, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Mel Herbert here. Let me just tell you how to use this little LSA program. You ready? Listen to the audio. It's really good. And then what you should do, though, is download those PDFs. If you go onto the website, you go to the download section, you download those PDFs, and you do the question sets. Those question sets are specifically created for you to get all knowledgeable before you sit the ABEM test. So listen to the audio, do those questions, and read the answers, and you'll get super-duper smart. And later on, we're going to post this stuff to a separate part of the website, and it's going to have CME. But there's been such an overwhelming demand that we're just posting them in the regular MRAP sort of stream of consciousness for now. So listen to the audio, and then go do those PDF question sets before you sit your ABEM test. It's going to make your life a lot easier. Herb it out.
MRAP listeners, this is Swami, and we are bringing you the LLSA 2016 review. This is going to be all the pearls that you need to quickly pass the test, which is what we all want to do. We'll have some pearls in here as well that are going to be relevant for your care as well, but we're really going to be focusing on getting you through that test. And who is the we? This month, I've got Jenny Beck Esme with me. Jenny and I worked at NYU for 4 years together when she was a resident. She's now over at St. Luke's Roosevelt, and she is terribly excited to delve into LLSA, right?
So excited. When we talked about doing this, I had to say, hey, Swami, what is LLSA? I have not done that
because
yet.
Because you're still getting board certified.
I am in the process of my board certification, but now I know all there is to know about LLSA, and I'm excited about it.
Oh, it is thrilling, and it's a great process. But we've got 13 papers, Jenny. We're going to move through these quickly. We're going to hone in on the pearls and give people the information they need. Let's start with the first article.
All right.
This one's on bacterial meningitis, Kowalski, bacterial meningitis post-PCV7, declining incidence and treatment, pediatric emergency care 2013. This is a short little article. I took all the short ones. Jenny got all the long ones. And there were two big goals here: to identify the current epidemiology of bacterial meningitis in various age groups and to implement an evidence-based approach to empiric therapy for suspected bacterial meningitis. The authors lead off by noting that since 1988, two major immunizations have drastically changed the face of bacterial meningitis. Haemophilus influenza type B vaccine, that's dropped the cases from this agent by 97%, pretty big. And then obviously the number two is the PCV7 vaccine, and this is the one that works against strep pneumonia. In order to treat suspected bacterial meningitis, you, of course, have to suspect it. And that's easier said than done, especially in kids. With older children, they're going to have very similar symptoms to what adults have: fever, headache, photophobia, vomiting, seizure, altered mental status. Infants are going to be a little different. They're going to be nonspecific. They're going to be fever or maybe hypothermia, especially in the less than 1 month age group. Vomiting, poor feeding, paradoxical irritability. These are things you're going to look for in infants. The key point that they come up with is that cultures of the CSF and peripheral blood should always be obtained. And if you can, get them prior to antibiotics. But if you can't do that, if it is difficult to do that, then give the antibiotics first. Get the cultures when you can. That's okay. Coming back to treatment, which is a big focus here, we have to think about how sick that patient is. In patients with hypotension or end organ damage, antibiotic administration takes precedence over everything. So yes, it's okay that the cultures will be lower yield. You got to save the patient first. Key point number three for them is the antibiotic regimen. In the group less than 1 month old, we're worried about things like strep A galactiae, E. coli, listeria, and our antibiotic regimen is going to be ampicillin plus cefotaxime or aminoglycoside. We should consider acyclovir in these patients as well if herpes is a possibility. In the group over 1 month old, we're worried about strep pneumonia and Neisseria meningitis. And in this group, we should be giving vancomycin and a third generation cephalosporin. Finally, they talk about steroids. Steroids may be beneficial in the group with Haemophilus influenza meningitis if given prior to or with the first dose of antibiotics. The problem is that we don't know if the patient has Haemophilus influenza when we're giving the steroids, but do your best. If you think about the steroids, give them. If you forget about it, don't kick yourself too hard. But for the test purposes, give the steroids with the first dose of antibiotics or before the first dose to get their maximal benefit.
Okay, so moving into our next article, this one is on anticoagulants and specifically on reversing warfarin when the patient is hemorrhaging. So it's this Frumpkin, rapid reversal of warfarin-associated hemorrhage in the emergency department by prothrombin complex concentrates, and this is from the Annals of Emergency Medicine 2013. So this is a review article about why warfarin-associated hemorrhage is important, but obviously you understand that. And the author goes by reviewing the kind of old ways that we had to reverse warfarin, so vitamin K, FFP, and recombinant factor 7A, and then kind of lays out an argument for why prothrombin complex concentrates, or PCC, is better. So breaking this down into kind of three key points. The first is that PCC is better than FFP. So PCC works much faster than FFP, and it should reverse the INR to less than 1.5 in less than 10 to 30 minutes. So after 10 to 30 minutes, you should recheck the INR, and if it's still too high, you could redose your PCC. It also infuses at a volume that's less than FFP. So for your patients who have a volume issue, your CHFers, this is going to be a better option. And then also, it's good to know that it does not carry this increased risk of thromboembolism. So there's this thought that if I give PCC, my patient's going to be at risk for clotting. That actually doesn't bear out when it's compared to FFP. Okay, key point.
So you don't take them from bleedy to clotty by giving PCC. FFP, though, does. So this is something to think about. Absolutely.
Yeah. Key point number two is comparing PCC to recombinant factor 7A. And here, also, it looks like PCC is probably better. The issue with recombinant factor 7A is it's just one factor. So while it might be correcting the INR, there's really no way to know that that's actually making the patient less bleedy. So PCC, which is going to be more complex concentrates, a broader reversal of the warfarin is probably a better option. Also, thrombotic events were seen more commonly in the recombinant factor 7A than with PCC. So it is going to make them more clotty. So maybe not a good option. And then the last thing, the really key point here, is that your hospital, your department, should come up with a warfarin reversal protocol that everyone knows and everyone uses. And in that, you have to be sure to be giving vitamin K. So IV vitamin K should be given early for nearly all patients with life-threatening bleeding who are on warfarin. So don't forget the vitamin K.
Yeah, and that vitamin K, it's not going to work right away. We know that. But what happens if you don't give it is you get this rebound bleeding. So after these factors start to wear off, you get rebound bleeding because the patient can't make their own factors. So vitamin K, essential piece of management. Forget about the test on this one. Vitamin K, it's got to be in your protocol. And Jenny, that brings us to the third paper on community-acquired pneumonia. This is by Wunderink and colleagues, Clinical Practice, Community-Acquired Pneumonia, New England Journal of Medicine, 2014. I love these papers that are these concise summaries of everything you need to know about a topic that is very common. The New England Journal of Medicine does a good job with these. And they have a couple of key points they list. They have six in there, but I'm going to, again, narrow it down to the stuff that is really testable. First of all, CAP is defined as the presence of a bacterial infection in the lower respiratory tract with fevers, chills, and leukocytosis, respiratory symptoms like cough or sputum production, shortness of breath, chest pain, and an abnormal pulmonary examination. They may or may not have a new infiltrate on X-ray. Sometimes you can't rely on that. For it to be CAP, the patient has to be coming from outside the hospital without any recent hospital admissions. Key point number one is that most CAP patients, most patients with a community-acquired pneumonia who require hospitalization, can either be treated with a respiratory fluoroquinolone or a cephalosporin plus a macrolide. Our typical is something like ceftriaxone plus azithromycin. Key point number two is that most patients with community-acquired pneumonia can go home. And the treatment for those patients is going to be doxycycline, a fluoroquinolone, or possibly a macrolide. Now, of course, since this paper came out, because it's 4 years old and things have changed, the resistance to strep pneumo for macrolides has grown quite a bit, so I would err on the side of either doxycycline or that fluoroquinolone. Key point number three, the alternate antibiotic therapy should be based on the presence of multiple risk factors for healthcare-associated pneumonia. So if they've been hospitalized for more than 2 days in the last 3 months, residents in a nursing home or extended care facility, long-term infusion therapy, hemodialysis in the last 30 days, home wound care, immunosuppression, or structural lung disease. And then key point number four is to suspect MRSA if any of the following are present. Do they have a cavitary lesion or necrosis, rapidly increasing pleural effusion, gross hemoptysis, concurrent influenza, an erythematous rash, neutropenia, skin pustules, severe pneumonia in the summer months, or young and previously healthy? And in those patients, you're going to have to add vancomycin to your antibiotic regimen. Jenny, any thoughts on CAP?
Ah, no, I think that was a great summary. I'm curious and interested to think more about getting rid of the macrolides in my outpatient treatment of CAP. That's a good point.
Yeah, you really have to think about that, because it's not that you were going to get rid of them. We still need to cover the atypicals, but you might have to expand the coverage. Doxy covers both. You could always add your amoxicillin to your macrolide. This is something we've covered on MRAP in the past, but you really have to think about the fact that azithromycin may simply not be enough because strep pneumo is getting more resistant to it.
Yeah, sounds good.
Let's do our next paper, Jenny. You've got something on endocrine, some glucose metabolism.
Yes, this is by Van Ness Autonu. I don't have any idea if I'm
No, that sounds right. Totally right. That's perfect.
I think that's got to be right. hyperglycemic crisis from the Journal of Emergency Medicine in 2013. Now, this is a dense review article. There is a lot to unpack in this, and it covers the presentation, the evaluation, and the treatment of hyperglycemic crises, including both diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA, and hyperosmolar hyperglycemic state. There's not a ton in here that I think is going to be new to anybody out there practicing emergency medicine, but I do think it's a really solid review article on this. So it kind of breaks down some key points, and there's a great little review table on the pearls and pitfalls, things not to mess up when you're treating these hyperglycemic crises. So the first thing to think about, the first key point, is that infection is the most common precipitant of a hyperglycemic crisis. So make sure you're thinking about infection in a patient who's coming in one of these states. But you also have to maintain a broad differential. So you got to be thinking about any other critical illness that could have precipitated their high glucose. So things like MI, CVA, toxins, and other endocrine emergencies like hyperthyroidism or adrenal disorders could all push a patient into a hyperglycemic crisis. Key point number two, always avoid hypokalemia in treating these patients. So check the potassium before you give the insulin. If it's above 5.2, you can start the insulin. If it's between 3.3 and 5.2, you can begin the insulin, but also give 20 to 30 milliequivalents of K with every liter of fluid. And then if it's less than 3.3, hold off on the insulin, supplement the K until it's above 3.3, and then start the insulin while continuing the K. So make sure you're avoiding hypokalemia in these patients. Key point number three, we want to get these patients back to euglycemic, but we don't want them to get hypoglycemic. So there is, as of right now, no benefit to bolusing the insulin at the start. So that old-fashioned bolus and then start a drip is kind of out. Here they're recommending just starting an insulin drip at 0.14 units per kilogram per hour. And then make sure you're checking that glucose every hour. And when the sugar starts to drop, you're going to want to change your fluids from normal saline to a solution that includes some dextrose. Also in that maintaining the euglycemia while avoiding hypoglycemia is that your target glucose range is a little bit different between DKA and the HHS. So you're going to try and keep your glucose between 150 and 200 in DKA when you're putting your dextrose in the fluids. And for HHS, it's a little more liberal. You want that sugar actually up between 2 and 300. Okay, the next key point, volume resuscitate. We want to correct their total body losses of kind of 6 to 9 liters over 24 to 48 hours. So you don't have to slam it all in super fast at the start, but you do need to give them a lot of volume. The key point number five, you want to overlap the sub-Q and the IV insulin. So this is for those patients that are hanging out in your department the whole time they're correcting their DKA. If you're getting to the point where you're going to maybe stop their insulin infusion, you want to overlap with some sub-Q insulin by at least 1 to 2 hours to avoid some rebound of the hyperglycemic state. I think that's about it.
All right, let's move on from the super critical care stuff of DKA and HHS to conjunctivitis, Jenny. Conjunctivitis, that's the next one on the list.
Super intense. This is from Azari, Conjunctivitis, a Systematic Review of Diagnosis and Treatment from JAMA. It's a great article. Take a look at it if you're at all curious about conjunctivitis. It really just breaks conjunctivitis down into three major categories: viral, bacterial, and allergic. The things to know are that most of the conjunctivitis is viral, so it's really not going to get better with any antibiotics at all. The thing to know about bacterial conjunctivitis is it's probably going to get better on its own no matter what. Topical antibiotics really just reduce the duration of the disease, but they're not going to change the outcomes at all. Really, you want to give antibiotics if the patient wears contacts or if they're immunocompromised, or if you're worried about a chlamydial or a gonococcal conjunctivitis, then definitely do the antibiotics. Otherwise, it's probably not doing much of anything. And then last, allergic conjunctivitis is also pretty common. These are the ones that have the red eye and the itch. So if there's a lot of itching going on, think about allergic conjunctivitis. Here, you give them some topical saline solution or artificial tears to kind of wash out the allergens, and that's probably about it.
All right, let's move into the sixth paper, Jenny. This one's yours, too. This is about ethical principles.
Yeah, so this is from Jesus from the ASEP Ethics Committee. Physician orders for life-sustaining treatment and emergency medicine, ethical considerations, legal issues, and emerging trends from Annals of Emergency Medicine. And now this is a really good article to kind of introduce you to the concept of the POLST, or the physician orders for life-sustaining treatment. And the main thing here is that this document was created to fill a kind of void between the DNR DNI and the advanced directives. The idea is the DNR DNI orders are really too narrow. They only cover this one thing and they don't help us figure out what to do in more complex situations. Advanced directives can be these massive documents that lay out all sorts of stuff and don't really help us in emergencies. So the POLST was created to fill this void, and it has the patient answer some very specific questions about what they want done. So it breaks things into CPR, medical interventions, including intubation, antibiotics, hydration, and nutrition, and allows them to answer specifically in all those different categories the stuff we need to know in the ER about what they want done. So it's a great document for us to understand. The other thing to make sure you know about it is that, as with any of these forms, DNRs, DNIs, advanced directives, you need to always confirm with the patient if ever possible. So if the patient has capacity, decide whether they have capacity or not. And if they do have capacity, review that these documents are still expressing their wishes. So it's really the meat of what this is talking about.
These POLST forms are becoming more and more common. We have to get more and more familiar with them. This is a nice little introduction, but we're going to have to learn more about this and something that we have addressed on MRAP in the past. So go over there and check out our discussion of the POLST form. Jenny, the next paper is on fever in the post-op patient, something that we were obsessed about when I was a medical student in surgery. This is from Emergency Medicine Clinics of North America and a little bit of an approach of what to think about. The classic that we learned was that we have to worry about wind in the 1 to 2 days post-op, that's atelectasis, water in the 2 to 3 day post-op period, that's a UTI, the wound in the 3 to 7 day post-op period, so a wound infection, walking, so did the patient develop a venous thromboembolism 5 to 7 days post-op, and then finally, if they have a fever more than 7 days out, think about the wonder drugs, the drug fever that could possibly happen. Now, the honest truth is that when these patients present to the emergency department with fever, they've had a recent surgery, we are going to be focused on whether they have a wound issue, whether this is something to do with the surgery, but let's make sure that we broaden it and think about all the other things as well. The first key point these authors make is that on post-op day 5, the most common sources of fever are wound infection, that's about 40%, UTI, about 30%, and then pneumonia, about 12%. So these are the things that we have to be thinking about. Key point number 2 is the big causes of early post-op fever. The things we have to consider are necrotizing skin infections, pulmonary embolism, an anatomic leak if the patient had abdominal surgery, alcohol withdrawal, not one that I always think about because, you know, these were surgical patients, but we have to think, is this something that didn't have to do with the surgery itself? Adrenal insufficiency, another one that doesn't really have to do with the patient themselves, and then malignant hyperthermia. And that's going to be very close to the operative window, not something that's going to present 5 or 6 days afterwards when they're coming in from home. For neck fash, the authors talk about the larynx score. This is something you can look up on MD Calc or just Google it. And it's a reasonable tool to use. It relies on a lot of different lab parameters to make the diagnosis. But if the patient looks really sick, sicker than that infection looks on the skin, think about neck fash. PE is going to require your regular evaluation. Again, ethanol withdrawal, something that we are pretty familiar with. So think about how much did the patient drink before they had their surgery. And then the next key point that they really hone in on is adrenal insufficiency, something that we can miss pretty easily. Any stress that the patient gets if they're on chronic steroid supplementation is going to increase their need for steroids. So if the patient looks septic after a procedure, give stress dose steroids, typically 100 milligrams of hydrocortisone. All right, Jenny, let's move to the next one, more on bleeding. This one's on hemostatic disorders.
Yep, this is from Hunt. It's Bleeding and Coagulopathies in Critical Care from the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, again, this is a big, dense review article. They go through all possible options of coagulopathies. So I tried to pick out key points from kind of each different one to make sure you got the major bullet points here. So key point one, don't just correct lab values. Only be correcting these lab values if the patient is having a bleeding problem that you're seeing or they're having a required surgery. Don't just fix them to fix them. Key point number two, We don't really, as of right now, have a definitive answer on the best transfusion ratio of plasma to red cells. So apparently in Europe, they're doing it different than we are in North America. But just remember that this is still up for debate.
And let's remember, this is from 2014, Jenny. Since then, we have had multiple studies looking at this. And most of us are trying to go to a 1-to-1-to-1 transfusion ratio. But, you know, 4 years ago, we didn't have all that information.
That's a pretty good point, actually. Key point three. Tranexamic acid, TXA, should be given to all of your patients who have major bleeding after trauma. Just give it. There's no more debate there. Key point four, there's really not good evidence to support giving FFP to correct abnormal coagulation tests prior to an invasive procedure. So you don't have to do it just to correct abnormal tests. Key point five, sepsis is the most common cause of DIC, and DIC usually presents with bleeding. Only about 5-10% of those patients are going to present with microthrombi. Key point six, in thrombocytopenia, transfuse at a threshold of 10,000 for a stable patient and 50,000 for an actively bleeding patient. And key point seven, this is an interesting one. We often remember that liver failure will result in an elevated INR, but these patients are losing both their procoagulants and their anticoagulants that are produced by the liver. So they actually result with a coagulopathy that's more similar to DIC than to warfarin use. So their lab tests are going to be pretty similar to a DIC patient. And then key point eight, bleeding that's due to renal disease is typically due to impaired platelet function. So this is going to give you ecchymosis, purpura, epistaxis, and bleeding from puncture sites.
Very nice. And that seventh point about liver dysfunction brings us nicely into the next paper, acute liver failure in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Absolutely. So this is another review article that talks about acute liver failure, which is actually super rare. It's when patients have liver failure and they don't have a pre-existing liver disease. So the main things that you want to know here are that the most common cause globally is from infection, so hepatitis A and hepatitis E. But in the United States, the most common cause is going to be drug-induced liver failure, so acetaminophen, Tylenol being the most common culprit. The key point that I think you need to know from treatment is that they're pointing out in this article that N-acetylcysteine or NAC is probably beneficial for patients who have acute liver failure even when it's not Tylenol induced. So we know to reach for it when they have the acetaminophen overdose, but you should probably be considering NAC for acute liver failure of really any cause. Okay, and then the last key point to take up from this article is that the encephalopathy is thought to be the result of elevated ammonia levels and places the patient at increased risk for cerebral edema and intracranial hypertension. So these are bad. Now, patients with chronic liver failure have developed compensatory mechanisms, making these complications super uncommon. That's good. Now, what this article is pointing out, and I didn't realize actually until reading this article, was that treatments for the hyperammonemia that are used in chronic liver failure, so things like neomycin, rifaximin, and lactulose, are actually not helpful in the acute liver failure setting, and they may actually be harmful. So I don't think you should be reaching for those medications in the acute liver failure patient. So if a patient comes in with no medical history and they seem like they're in acute liver failure, these are probably not your go-to. Your go-to in that case might actually just be NAC.
Interesting. So any kind of liver failure, reach for NAC, think about it. Obviously, the acetaminophen is a layup, but the other ones, we should probably be reaching for it as well. I think that is the big critical take-home point. That moves us from tox stuff, or kind of tox GI stuff, to sepsis. And the first article that we have to look at is by Yeely, and this is the Process Investigators, a randomized trial of protocol-based care of septic shock, New England Journal of Medicine. And Jenny, I think that you'd literally have to be living under a rock to have not heard about the Process trial, as well as the Arise and the Promise trial. These have been everything that we've been talking about for the last couple of years as far as early goal-directed therapy. Now, the EGDT model is from Manny Rivers in 2000. It was clearly superior to routine care. And what Yeely and his colleagues were looking at was, do we need to do all of that stuff or not? The bottom line key point we have to take home is that there was no difference between the protocol-based early goal-directed therapy arm in comparison to routine care in terms of 60-day mortality. Now, that being said, the authors note, and many other people have noted, that the reason that's there is because we have drastically changed what we do because of Manny Rivers' work back in 2000. So we are doing a better job with our basic resuscitation. We probably just don't have to do all of the things that Rivers pointed out. Key point number two is that good sepsis care involves three pieces and three pieces only. Early identification, early administration of appropriate broad-spectrum antibiotics, and administration of IV crystalloids. These are the three things that the PROCESS study focuses in on. And Jenny and I are aware that the last point has come under fire in recent years, and for the purpose of LLSA, early identification, early antibiotics, IV crystalloids, and that current recommendation is 30 cc's per kilo of crystalloids. We know that there's some debate around this, but that's what you need to know for the LLSA.
Yep, that's what happens when we're looking at articles from 4 years ago. But for the test, that's the answer.
Yeah, things change. We move forward. And let's move forward with the next paper on small bowel obstruction. This is by Taylor in Academic Emergency Medicine, Adult Small Bowel Obstruction. This is a systematic review of all of the literature out there trying to help guide our management. What is actually useful in making this diagnosis? They start by talking about historical features, and they key in on two things: prior history of abdominal surgery and constipation. Those are probably the two historical features that are actually useful. With the physical exam, again, there's only a couple of studies that looked at it, but the two pieces that are really important are the presence of abdominal distension. That is the most predictive finding for a small bowel obstruction, or abnormal bowel sounds. That one's pretty good too, but we should really focus in on abdominal distension from the physical exam. X-rays are not great. If you find that you have greater than or equal to 2 air fluid levels in the dilated loops of small bowel, that's pretty useful, but don't bank on your X-ray. The other modalities that we need to embrace are CT and MRI and ultrasound. And actually, ultrasound performed better than CT or MRI. So here are the big key points to take home. When it comes to the physical, the money's with abdominal distension. When it comes to imaging, CT is the modality we are most commonly going with, and we're looking for continuous dilated loops of bowel greater than 2.5 centimeters. And then finally, while CT is great, ultrasound is actually better. If you are given the choice between CT and ultrasound, go with the ultrasound.
That is so interesting.
That the ultrasound is that good?
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, definitely not what we were taught. But the key, obviously, is that you need to have someone who knows how to do the ultrasound.
I love it.
That's not going to be present in most departments, but it might be present on the LLSA.
Good point.
All right, let's move from there to pericarditis. This is a key article. This is really a great one to know about. New England Journal of Medicine, the ICAP investigators, a randomized trial of colchicine for acute pericarditis. This was a randomized trial comparing colchicine to standard practice. And what they found was that colchicine was better. The patients who got colchicine did better. That is the big key point. If the patient has pericarditis and you can give them colchicine, they don't have some contraindication to it, give them the colchicine. As far as diagnosing pericarditis, they point out you have to have 2 of the following 4: classic pericarditis symptoms, classic EKG changes, the presence of a pericardial effusion, or the presence of a pericardial friction rub. Let's be honest. What we are most likely going to find is not the pericardial friction rub. It's tough to find. We're really going to be looking for those other 3 findings, any 2 of them, and we've got the diagnosis locked in. Now, as far as the treatment, we're going to give high-dose aspirin or ibuprofen for 7 to 10 days. You're going to want to give that with a PPI because it's going to irritate the stomach, and then give colchicine as well. The primary outcome here was the occurrence of either incessant or recurrent pericarditis, and it was really reduced in the group that got colchicine with an NNT of 5. So again, bottom line, give them all colchicine.
Great. I think we have one more article after this.
Yep, one more article. This one's on procedural sedation and analgesia by Goodwin in the Annals of Emergency Medicine. This is by the ACEP group, Clinical Policy, Procedural Sedation and Analgesia in the Emergency Department. Now, this is a long clinical policy, but it's got some really good pieces in it. They asked 4 critical questions, and we'll go through each of those and just say what the key take-home points were. Does pre-procedural fasting reduce the risk of emesis? No. Level B evidence, do not delay PSA in adults or pediatric patients for fasting time. Question number 2, does the routine use of capnography reduce the incidence of adverse respiratory events? Level B evidence, capnography may be used as an adjunct, but it doesn't have to be done. Question number 3, how many providers needed to be in a PSA for it to be safe? Level B, 2 people need to be there, a nurse and then someone who's qualified to do the administration of drugs and the procedure itself. Question number 4, can ketamine, propofol, etomidate, dexmedetomidine, alfentanil, and remifentanil be used safely? Level A, ketamine can be safely given to kids for PSA. Level B, etomidate is fine for adults. Ketofol is fine for kids and adults. And level C, ketamine is fine in adults. Alfentanil is fine in adults. And etomidate is good in kids. And this really just speaks to the fact that there's not a lot of evidence studying ketamine for adults, although we have a lot of practice of doing that. The key take-home points one more time: don't delay your procedural sedation and analgesia for fasting. It's completely unnecessary. A minimum of 2 providers should be present for any PSA, 1 to monitor the patient and 1 to do the procedure. And then finally, all of the available agents are safe in the hands of emergency physicians, but select the right agent for your patient. And Jenny, that is 13 articles for the 2016 LLSA. Listen to this. You will pass the test.